Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the films Green Book, The Possession of Hannah Grace, At Eternity's Gate, and The Favorite. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring the original Rankin-Bass Christmas specials. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Netflix has canceled Daredevil, the series. And the reason that's important to note, because they canceled Luke Cage and they canceled Iron Fist, which were sort of these lesser Marvel TV series on Netflix. The reason that's raising some eyebrows is because, first of all, Daredevil is considered sort of the crown jewel in the Netflix Marvel series run. It's the better of all the shows, that along with like Jessica Jones. Now watch out, Jessica Jones is on the chopping block as well. So is The Punisher too, because all those are Marvel characters. And it has less to do with the quality of the shows. It has everything to do with the fact that I think Disney is, and they've been telegraphing this for a while, Disney is trying to set things up to have their own streaming service. It's the same reason why Disney has systematically, since they bought Marvel, they have been paring away other studios' involvement in the films. They managed to detangle Paramount from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They've still got some baggage with Sony, but now they've got Fox in their wheelhouse and they can absorb that into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This is because Marvel wants control of everything, and I understand that. This is just Disney protecting its own interest in wanting to have full control over their stuff. What's happening right now is you're seeing everything diversifying into its own specific services, so you'd have to spend $150 subscribing to Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime and HBO and Disney and CBS and all this kind of stuff if you want to watch everything you want to watch. And then the next logical step is there will be a service that will consolidate all of those into one channel, and you're back to the cable model again. It's going to be all cyclical. So watch this space for that stuff coming. The next piece of news I want to hit really quickly is Bernardo Bertolucci has died at the age of 77 of lung cancer. And he was the director of The Last Tango in Paris. So it is somebody you look back on their career when they pass away. One of the things about this, though, is it's been causing some, less than positive stories to be written, because there have been allegations of Bertolucci being not on the up and up in dealing with the lead actress in Last Tango in Paris. And she has since passed away, because that movie was made almost 50 years ago. She had complained about basically feeling like she was being assaulted during some of these scenes. And Bertolucci had an illustrious career. He did other movies like The Last Emperor, Sheltering Sky, Little Buddha, Stealing Beauty, and The Dreamers, which was about 15 years ago. He always worked with taboo subjects. The Dreamers was an NC-17 movie, actually. And The Last Tango in Paris, which I've seen. I've never been a big fan of The Last Tango in Paris. I always thought it was somewhat stupid. But, and especially since it was such a graphic sexual movie, that one got an X rating originally. And it's really, honestly, if you watch it now, it's kind of tame in today's world compared to some of the stuff we see on cable and everything. You know, that sort of colors the eulogizing that's been going on about him. But the other thing that happened is film critic David Edelstein from NPR was fired for making a joke about this element of the film. I can't go into it because it's radio, but he made a joke, and it was kind of crass, but it really, honestly, it wasn't that bad. But again, we're in a world where people lose entire careers like Roseanne Barr did over a tweet that was ill thought out and ill mannered. And even though Edelstein's wasn't a racist tweet, it caused problems with the Me Too movement and supposedly insensitive, even though there's a lot of stuff that's been weirdly taken out of context with that. But do realize that there are consequences to your actions and the actions of people who are commenting on this stuff, even if, in my opinion, what you said wasn't necessarily a fireable offense. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is one that's coming up pretty soon, in just a couple weeks, and that is Once Upon a Deadpool, opening on December 14th.
Right before Christmas, a good guy in red is coming to theaters with his new sidekick, Fred.
Why am I here?
You're in a PG-13 version of Deadpool, filtered through the prism of childlike innocence.
I'm a grown
man. And nobody
man.
Does childlike innocence like you, Fred. Nobody. I need you almost as much as you need me.
I don't need you at all.
You need me to untie you once we're done.
Once Upon a Deadpool.
Kind of prefer Marvel movies.
We are Marvel.
Yeah, but you're, you know, Marvel licensed by Fox. It's like if the Beatles were produced by Nickelback. It's music, but it sucks.
You were nicer as a kid.
Now, what's neat about this is they're taking the point to make a PG-13 version of Deadpool. I'm assuming it's a Deadpool 2 that they're doing. I don't know. Are they going to put both movies together to make a massive Deadpool film? It is not uncommon for Hollywood to recut PG-13 versions of movies. If you recall, they did that with The King's Speech. I think they wanted, because of, it had all the swearing in it, they took that out and they re-released it in theaters hoping people would go. That didn't work. And it's not uncommon for a movie to get like an NC-17 or an unrated release and then be recut for an R-rated release to try and get more box office. It doesn't happen every week. It's certain you get one or two of those a year, maybe. So it's not an unheard of thing, but it is kind of a big deal because Deadpool is such a big movie and it's such a big franchise. And it's a hilarious trailer because they've got Fred Savage, of course, from The Princess Bride in the same setup as he was in The Princess Bride. I don't know if they're going to use that as a framing device in the film. I'm actually considering going to see this just because I'm curious to see how they make the Deadpool PG-13. And I think you can do it. Absolutely, I think you can do it as long as you still keep funny jokes in there. It just, you have to take out all the dirty ones. But there still are plenty of funny jokes that Deadpool says that aren't dirty or aren't R-rated dirty. So who knows? I may be in the theaters for that one. The other one I want to hit has caused a bit of a hubbub, and that is The Lion King, which opens next year.
Everything the light touches is our kingdom. But a king's time as ruler rises and falls like the sun. One day, the sun will set on my time here and will rise with you as the new king.
This actually got a bit of a backlash because it's essentially a reshoot of, or shoot in quotes, a reshoot of the original trailer for The Lion King. And people are saying, oh, it's a live action version of The Lion King. But people, like the internet and the social media has rightfully so taken Disney to task, saying this isn't live action. It just looks live action. There's not a single pixel of this trailer that is shot on a camera. This is all done in a computer. Now, it looks fantastic, and I mean, we're 10 years past Avatar now, and the digital environment and creature design is gorgeous, but this is an animated movie. As much as the original Lion King is an animated movie, it's just you're using computers with photorealism instead of ink and paint. And that's okay. I'm curious to see what a photorealistic Lion King is going to look like. And I'm curious to see how different it's going to be. Like Beauty and the Beast deviated quite a bit. And a lot of these live action remakes, quote unquote live action remakes, have deviated a bit. Even the Jungle Book is quite different than the original cartoon. So, you know, we'll see. I'm curious to see what ends up happening with this. It's still going to make tons of money because of nostalgia, but I'm curious to see if this sort of backlash continues or if people get over it, which they probably will. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Possession of Hannah Grace and At Eternity's Gate. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. The first one I want to talk about is The Possession of Hannah Grace. A new worker in a deserted morgue starts to suspect the corpse of a woman who died during an exorcism is coming back to life.
Well, I got a weird one for you. Her name is Hannah Grace. And her family was performing an exorcism or something on her. Something went wrong. And she died in the middle of it. You know what they say. If an exorcism isn't completed, evil will find a new vessel.
This is the only brand new movie this week. It is a strange release cycle right now. And you get this a lot. What ends up happening is you get a weekend with a lot of movies and big releases. And you had that last week because it was Thanksgiving week and you had Creed 2 and you had Ralph Breaks the Internet. Those are the two big ones, but you also had going wide that Robin Hood movie that nobody saw. And you also had Green Book, which we're going to talk about this week. Now, what's funny is last week, the studios stupidly are like, well, we only want to screen your movie like 2 days ahead of time. We don't want you seeing it too early because they're worried people are going to get spoilers or something. They want to control the narrative. So what they end up doing is saying, well, let's just screen them all like that week of release. Well, the problem is on Thanksgiving, which falls on a Thursday, and all movies tend to open on Wednesday. And nowadays, almost every movie on the planet gets a preview night. They start showing it like 7 or 8 or 9 o'clock the night before, which essentially means all these movies opened on Tuesday. So there was one day they could screen movies, and that was on Monday. And so last week for us on the local press, you had Ralph Breaks the Internet, Creed 2, and Green Book all in the same night, which is just stupid. They should have screened Wreck-It Ralph on a Saturday morning so that the kids could go see it. And they should have screened Green Book a week beforehand, gotten some buzz for it. But no, they crammed them all into one, and that limits the amount of time people are going to talk about it. And, you know, you had 4 main movies opening last week, and then this week they kind of dial it back and you don't get it. And you get that right the weekend after 4th of July. You get that the weekend after Memorial Day. You get that the second weekend of May, because the first weekend of May is always a big release day. It's not uncommon to have the lull after the big push of releases. Then don't worry, in a couple weeks, there's going to be more movies than you can handle. There's going to be, I think, something like a dozen or two movies opening between December 14th and the end of the year. I mean, it's an insane amount of movies that are coming out in like a 2-week period. But for right now, The Possession of Hannah Grace is the only movie. And they always try and drop a horror movie after Thanksgiving, like right at the beginning of December. I remember that happened with that movie, The Pyramid, which was a horror movie, a found footage film. They do that a lot. These movies never do well. Horror movies never seem to do well at this time. And that's because nobody's thinking horror movies. You know, the closest you ever get is something like Black Christmas, which is specifically tied to Christmas, and even that one flopped when it came out. October's a time to release horror movies. Also, it was the summertime. Like, August is a great time to release horror movies. January tends to be a really good time to release horror movies. End of November, early December, they just get lost. Nobody's going to go see this movie. And that's kind of a shame, because this looks kind of interesting. I have a soft spot for people working in a morgue movies. There's that one with Ewan McGregor, Night Watch, like 20 years ago that was interesting. The Autopsy of Jane Doe was another one that's a really interesting movie. And they're kind of cool settings because it is just inherently creepy because it's a morgue filled with dead bodies. And this one looks like it has certain elements. I'm hearing some buzz that it may not be so good, and that's not a big surprise. But it's kind of a shame that they're cramming this one into the release schedule when I think it probably deserved a better shot. It didn't get screened, so I'm going to have to say that The Possession of Hannah Grace has to get a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is At Eternity's Gate. Willem Dafoe plays legendary painter Vincent van Gogh in his later years, including the time of his death.
There's something inside me. I don't know what it is. What I see, nobody else sees.
You're a stranger here. You drink too much. You're hysterical, out of control.
I don't want to calm down. It's called the act of painting for a reason.
Go away!
Don't you see that this painting is unpleasant? The townspeople have signed a petition against you. They don't want you to come back.
I can't stay here, Vincent.
You're surrounded by stupid, wicked, ignorant people.
This is an award film. It's getting a very limited release. I think it's in about 50 theaters right now, but I think it came out in limited release like a week or two ago. So I figured it was worth catching because, you know, you don't have anything new aside from The Possession of Hannah Grace. And so I figured I'd give this one a whirl. It's getting pushed as an award film, and it's directed by the guy who did The Diving Bell and The Butterfly, which is a very intimate piece. And what's funny is I help my father out a lot. He's gotten old, so he needs some help here and there. And so I'll bring him over to my place and while I'm getting stuff done. And I told him, I said, hey, you know, it's award season, so you're going to start watching award films. And so I've shown him a handful of these with screeners because I've got to watch them. And this was not his kind of movie. This is, my dad's the kind of guy who, he just likes to see a movie. He doesn't like movies that bad things happen to good people. He wants your very typical mainstream science fiction, Western adventure. I showed him The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He thought that was kind of interesting. He's a very basic mainstream film kind of guy. And even then, he's got very, very limited tastes. He just kind of likes a certain type of movie. So this movie is not at all something he'd want to see. And he hated every minute of it. It was almost more entertaining watching him squirm watching this movie than actually watching the movie. Because the movie itself is like an hour, 50 minutes. So it's not like this 3-hour monstrosity. But it is a bit of a slag. I mean, it's about Vincent van Gogh, and van Gogh was a depressing person, and he was a depressed person, and he had some serious issues. Now, Willem Dafoe is a little bit long in the tooth to be playing Vincent van Gogh. I mean, Vincent van Gogh died at like 37, and Willem Dafoe is like in his 60s. So he's playing a little off his age range, but he does a good job. And there's been a fascination with Vincent van Gogh for the last couple of years. And a lot of that, I think, stems from the theory that he maybe didn't kill himself, that maybe it was a manslaughter thing, an accidental homicide by somebody else. And I think that makes an interesting case, and it is interesting to contemplate. This one is a typical award film. I said to my father, I said, this is exactly what you see every year. It's sort of a passion piece for somebody in a acting spotlight that is a very small release that is getting a lot of praise, but a whole lot of people aren't going to go see it. It's just, it's a slow movie. It's beautifully shot, and it is meant to be in the state of mind that Van Gogh is. So it's a bit hectic, disjointed, sometimes uncomfortable, but also beautiful. You see the beauty in the chaos that was Van Gogh's life, even though his life was relatively mundane, but it is a look, a very intimate look into him. So if you're a fan of Van Gogh and you study Van Gogh, I'm sure you'd appreciate it, but it does take its toll. It's not a long movie, but it's a long-winded movie at times. It's very typical of the beautifully shot, well-acted, but overly hand-wringing art film. And that's really not my cup of tea. So I'm going to have to say that At Eternity's Gate, while well-constructed, kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Green Book and The Favorite. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. I'm going to review Green Book, and it came out last week. I talked a little bit about the release schedule and the screening schedule from last week. Again, this was a movie, this is very typical of award season. It was screened at an inopportune time. I wasn't able to see it. And then, like 5 days later, I got a disc in the mail from Universal saying, hey, for your consideration. So I figured, hey, this is worth checking out. I wanted to see this anyways. I know they screened it. I give them credit for trying to screen it, but they just screened it at a terrible time. I also wanted to cover it because it's made some news. I'll talk about the certain weird polarization of it in a minute, but it got named Best Film of the Year by the National Board of Review, which was kind of a surprise because just leading into this award season, there is no front runner. There is no movie that seems to be garnering all the praise. And there are certain roles and actors that tend to be bubbling to the top. You know, Lady Gaga is, I think, going to get a nomination for A Star Is Born. I think Rami Malek's going to get a nomination for Bohemian Rhapsody. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm pretty sure that Christian Bale is going to get a nomination for Vice. So there are those characters and those actors, but there's no movie that is just like the one that everybody's saying, this is the odds-on favorite for everything. So when Green Book won, it kind of came out of the blue, and it's showing up on a lot of good lists. So I figure, hey, this is worth talking about because this thing's going to have legs, mark my word. So in Green Book, Viggo Mortensen plays the driver of a classical pianist played by Mahershala Ali, who embarks on a concert tour of the Deep South in 1962.
Some guy called over here, a doctor. He's looking for a driver. You interested?
I am not a medical doctor. I'm a musician. I'm about to embark on a concert tour in the Deep South. Do you foresee any issues in working for a black man?
You in the Deep South? There's gonna be problems.
This gentleman says that I'm not permitted to dine here.
I'm afraid not. How does he smile and shake their hands like that?
Because it takes courage to change people's hearts.
First of all, this movie, let's just talk about the movie itself. I thought this was actually quite good. And the reason it was quite good, how I can tell a movie is good, especially if it's an award film, if I put the movie in and I start watching it, I find myself sucked in and I look at the time, you know, because you can hit the info button on your DVD and you're like, holy cow, this movie's half over. I didn't even realize we got that far. I mean, it feels like it was only on for 15, 20 minutes and you're an hour in. That's a good movie. That has great pacing. Conversely, you know, something like that Van Gogh movie I was talking about, you get a movie and you hit, oh my God, it's only been 20 minutes. It feels like it's been on for an hour. There's a difference there. There's this weird time dilation of whether you're enjoying something. Green Book just flies by. And a lot of it has to do with both Mortensen and Ali's performances. They're both very, very good actors, and they have great chemistry with each other. And it's also really well directed. And it's directed by Peter Farrelly, who's one half of the Farrelly brothers. This is the guy who's partly responsible for movies like There's Something About Mary and Dumb and Dumber and Movie 43. Yet he's put together a really well-balanced, tempered, entertaining, compelling, and sweet and tender movie. And I praise him for it. It's a really well-done film. Now, it treads familiar ground. We've seen this sort of thing before. It's sort of this weird flip on the Driving Miss Daisy kind of thing. In this one, you've got a white guy driving around a black guy. And it deals head on with racial issues. It deals with Jim Crow era laws back in the South. And the fact that this black guy was going down into some of the tough areas for black people back then. And even now, sometimes, depending on where you go, it can be kind of tough in some places. I mean, there's a scene in there where they go to a town where it's a sunset town where black people aren't allowed out after night. And that seems kind of mad now, but you look at that, you know, 55 years ago, that was a real thing. And we tend to look at everything in the context of 2018 or whatever your present is. And so some of the Jim Crow laws that existed back pre-civil rights seem insane right now. But they were real, and this was one of the guys who went down there to sort of try and break that up, and he had to fight against the fact that, like, in one scene, he's not allowed to eat at the restaurant where he's going to be performing, just flat out not allowed. He's not allowed to use the restroom at a place. You know, these kind of things certainly were a norm in certain areas, and certain people had these views, and that's worth looking at because I think that we need to reexamine this every now and then. Now, what's interesting about it is it's getting a backlash. This movie is getting a backlash, and I've been seeing people say, well, this isn't about the black experience. This is a movie for white people. This is a movie for white people who feel guilty. And they compared to movies like In the Heat of the Night and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And they're like, well, this is all because the black person has to be perfect and the white guy has to be the one that grows. And I saw somebody complaining that Viggo Mortensen's getting the best actor push where Mahershala Ali's getting the best supporting actor push in the awards film. And I'm like, but it's Viggo's movie. It's his character's film. And here's the reality. Yes, if you want movies that tell the black experience by black directors, they're out there. You've got stuff like Sorry to Bother You. You've got If Beale Street Could Talk coming up in a couple weeks by Barry Jenkins. You've got those movies out there. This movie's not made for a black audience necessarily. It's just made for the standard mainstream audience. And not every movie that deals with civil rights has to be made for and by black people. In fact, if you want a movie that tries to change minds and hearts, you want it to be seen by everybody. Sort of like Black Panther. Black Panther was not a black person's movie. It was just a good movie. Get Out, even as steeped as it was in racial satire and commentary and social commentary, it was not a movie just for black people. You want a movie that's very like narrowly marketed to be like just for a certain culture? Something like the Tyler Perry films, while they're fans outside of that typical audience, those movies they're not even just, they're even more target marketed. They're gospel plays for Christian black women is what the Tyler Perry movies are aimed at. Now, other people can watch them, but that's who it's named at. It's just like Nicholas Sparks movies are movies that are made for white suburban housewives. You know, if you're drinking Chardonnay out of a box with your friends at 5 p.m, that's who's going to be watching Nicholas Sparks movie. It's the same people who watch the Hallmark movies. And there's nothing wrong with having those. There's nothing wrong with targeting a market. But for a movie like Green Book, Green Book is not Mahershala Ali's character's movie as much as it is Viggo Mortensen, because the change that has to come in a civil rights movie has to be with the mainstream and with the people in power. And yes, it does play out like a white savior scenario, but if that's who's in power, that's where the change has to come. Green Book does it, and it does it in a very kind and friendly and appropriate way. It reminds me of last year. You had Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, which was a big award contender, actually won some awards, and there were a lot of people that railed against it because they said it doesn't actually solve the racial problems, it doesn't do it head on, and it's not for black people, and this is terrible. Well, you know what? I thought Three Billboards was a fantastic film. Absolutely worth seeing. I feel the same way about Green Book. So I'm going to have to say in the end, Green Book totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I don't have much time, but I want to talk really quickly about The Favorite. Yorgos Lanthimos directs this period piece in which Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz star as women vying for the affections of Queen Anne in the early 1700s.
The Queen is an extraordinary person.
I apologize for my appearance. I hoped I might be employed here by you.
It is important to make new friends in court, is it not?
You're so beautiful.
Stop it, you mock me.
If I were a man, I would ravish you.
You have become close to Abigail.
She is a viper. You're jealous.
You must send Abigail away.
I do not want to.
I'm on my side. Always.
I think I'm actually going to have to review this on the other side of the break. I took so much time talking about Green Book and the racial implications of that, and it's worth talking about because I think that movie was mismarketed. It had a bad title, and it was not marketed for what it is, and I think it's going to have bigger legs than the initial release of last week said. I think you're going to see this movie just trucking along through the end of the year. But right now, I have to talk about The Favorite, which is another award film. This is the guy who directed The Lobster and The Killing of a Sacred Deer, so he deals with some really bizarre stuff. This is a little more grounded of a movie, but it still has plenty of strange things happening in it. I'll talk about that more on the other end of the break, along with the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring the original Rankin-Bass Christmas specials. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I need to continue talking about The Favorite because I spent so much time talking about Green Book, which is a great movie. Go see Green Book. It's a great movie. But let's talk about The Favorite now. Let's just talk about the elements of filmmaking. It's a gorgeously shot movie. It is beautifully shot. And it's done so in a way that it's not gorgeous the way like At Eternity's Gate is shot, which looks like a Van Gogh painting. This one is stark and dark and heavily contrasted. And it has these wide shots, and it takes place in a castle because it takes place in the early 1700s in Britain, and Queen Anne is in charge of everything. And it just gets that picturesque, almost cold view of royalty and wealth of that era, where you had abject poverty around the country, but this place was fully in wealth. But even then, when you watch it, her life's sort of pathetic, and the way she lives and how she lives is kind of pathetic. And just the fact that you're dealing with being in the early 1700s, where you don't have things like modern medicine or cleanliness and indoor plumbing, you know, that's what I've always found fascinating about these period pieces, that even the wealthiest of the wealthy at these times, the people who are fully have all the benefits that you can possibly have of the time, and they're still living worse than I live on my worst day, which kind of gives you a little bit of hope in terms of living in a modern world. But in terms of this movie, this is a fascinating film, because while I don't know how much I necessarily enjoyed it, I enjoyed its stark and upfront nature. It's essentially these two characters, and it's a historical thing where these ladies in waiting were vying for the attention of Queen Anne. And it gets really, really dark, and they're trying to sabotage each other. It starts out very nicey, but there's a lot of backstabbing going on and infighting and cattiness. And it's just fascinating to watch. What's funny is I showed it to my father. This is another one that I showed him, and he loves period pieces and he loves history, but he was bored by this because it wasn't really about history. There's a war going on that Queen Anne's dealing with, but they didn't deal with that much. And again, he doesn't like movies with characters that are unappealing, and all the characters are unappealing. Both women and then Queen Anne are just kind of nasty people, and he didn't particularly like it, but he appreciated sort of the historical context of it. It's different than Lanthimos's other films in the sense that it's more pragmatic and normal, but it goes into some weird context, and it's at times a disturbing movie that feels a bit on edge. So I'm going to have to say that The Favorite kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office really quickly. Last week, it was a big weekend for two of the big movies. Of course, Wreck-It Ralph won the weekend. If you just take the weekend, Wreck-It Ralph made $56 million. Creed made $35, $36 million. But they also each made about $20 to $30 million extra for the Wednesday and Thursday times as well. So they both did extremely well. Robin Hood flopped with less than $10 million for the 3-day weekend and less than $15 million for the 5-day. And then Green Book actually came in the top 10, but it only made about $5.5 million for the 3-day and about $8 million for the 5-day. This movie, I think, is going to have legs, more legs than Robin Hood. And I'm sure Creed and Ralph are going to have good legs as well as we go through the next 2 weeks, because there's not a whole lot of competition. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is the original Christmas special collection from Rankin Bass. It's from Universal Home Video, and it's been out since October. It's a Blu-ray set. And the reason they're pushing it now, of course, is because it's the holiday season. You can still get this. And it is 5 of the holiday specials, which are the classic sort of stop motion animation and cel animation from the 60s and 70s. And I'm just going to break these down really quickly and play little bits of them, because they're part of my childhood, and they're something that have made me love Christmas ever since I was a kid. And the first one, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Burl Ives narrates this classic tale of a reindeer trying to find his place in the North Pole.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows.
That nose!
All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call
him
names.
Look at the big trash knife!
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, you'll go down in history.
Won't you guide my sleigh tonight?
Now, I know this one actually is getting a little bit of news now, because people are kind of like waking up and saying there are a bunch of jerks in this movie. Donner, who's Rudolph's dad, is a real, he's basically like, you got that red nose, we got to hide you from the world, we can't even let Santa see you. And Santa's kind of a jerk about it too. Santa comes in and he's like, well, you can't be a reindeer if that nose of yours isn't going to be in the way. And I mean, it is a movie about misfits, and I like to think of myself as the king of the misfits sometimes. But then you also have to wonder, you know, just because Charlie in the Box is named Charlie, that's what's wrong with that? Or the doll. The doll is like, why the doll's depressed, and that's why the dolly's not a suitable toy. Or the fact that the elephant has polka dots on it, and that makes it a bad thing? I don't know. It's still Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is a sweet, fun little TV special, and it reminds me of what it was like when I was a kid. Now, another one on there is Frosty the Snowman, which is the cell animated. It's not using that stop-motion animation. A group of children build a snowman that comes to life through the magic of Christmas.
How about Frosty?
Frosty?
Yeah, Frosty it is! Frosty the Snowman!
Yay!
Yay!
Frosty the Snowman, what a happy, jolly soul! With a carved up pint and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal.
This is another one that gets a little bit dark at times because you got the magician following them around. Of course, it's based on the song, and they fill it into that context. And for some reason, the kids don't have parents and they wear shorts in winter and they go off on long trips, hopping trains like hobos with Frosty. And then the magician tries to straight up murders Frosty, which is kind of shocking, but it's still a fun little classic tale and things work out in that 30 minutes. The next one is, of course, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Fred Astaire narrates this tale of how Santa Claus came to be and where his traditions come from.
Thursday, visit the North Pole, where all year long folks have been getting ready for Christmas. This holiday season, Fred Astaire tells us how Santa got his start. A Christmas classic.
This is actually one of my favorite ones, even more so than Rudolph. I also love, it's not on this selection, but I also love The Year Without a Santa Claus with the Heat Miser guy. But this is the one that tells the story of Santa Claus, and it's an hour-long special, so it was longer than like Rudolph. And it has all the traditions, and it has some weird darkness to the story, which seems more normal from the 60s, but it's still a lot of fun. It has the Winter Warlock in it, who is this sort of this guardian of the forest that Santa Claus has to befriend. And I really enjoyed this one. I thought this one was one that really kind of dug deeper than just adapting a song. I mean, it is a song based on a song, but it does more than just adapt it. So this is one of my favorites out there. The next one is The Little Drummer Boy. Here's where it starts to get a little bit weird. A young orphan travels to Bethlehem to play his drum for the baby Jesus.
Happy birthday, Aaron.
Oh, Father, Mother, did you bring me something?
I don't suppose this would interest you, young man.
A drum! My very own drum! Oh, Father!
Try it out, Aaron.
And perhaps because it was a gift of love, the drum had an almost magical quality.
This is one I remember as a kid, and it played in the 80s, and then in the early 90s, it got banned because people were complaining that it portrayed Arabs in a bad light, because this Arab basically enslaves the drummer boy to get him to perform for him as a street performer. And that's kind of a shame, because when I watch this, I'm like, I don't think that it's not saying this about Arabs in general. It's just that's what the one character is. So this was one that got destroyed by political correctness in the 90s, and that's unfortunate. Now it's back, and you can watch it on Blu-ray. And what's interesting about it is it also gets pretty violent. They murder the kid's family in this movie, these bandits. And you don't, it's not on screen, but you see when it happens. And it's kind of shocking, kind of reminds me of the other one that they did, Rankin Bass did, the Nestor, the Long-Eared Christmas Donkey. But still, Little Drummer Boy was a blast from the past, although it doesn't look as remastered. It's a very murky image on the film. And the last one, I don't actually have a trailer for it, is Cricket on the Hearth. Based on a Charles Dickens story, a cricket witnesses the ups and downs of a London family around the holidays. This one is, I think, the second special that Rankin Bass did. It's traditional cell animation, and it's not very good. It stars Danny Thomas and Marlo Thomas, and it has Roddy McDowall as the cricket. It's not a great story. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and it's them trying to kind of recreate Magic in the Bottle with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and they ended up doing more stuff, and this one kind of got lost, but it's a neat little piece of television history to watch in the full set. So I'm going to have to say that the Rankin Bass Holiday Classic Collection totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Ben is Back, Mary Queen of Scots, and Vox Lux. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.